Okay, so we didn't finish chapter 4. We just kind of were running behind. So before we get back into chapter 4, if somebody could summarize for us those first, I think we got to through 14. If someone wants to summarize those first 14 verses, that would be great. Or what you took away from those first 14 verses.
Well, Mordecai, well, obviously the edict goes out that all the Jews are going to be killed in the 12th month. Mm-hmm. And so Mordecai goes into mourning, tears his clothes, and is wailing loudly. Esther hears about it and sends her eunuch to go figure out what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And so then they communicate through the eunuch, and Mordecai tells Esther that she needs to go before the king. And she's afraid because she hasn't been summoned in 30 days, and she's afraid she's going to die. And so Mordecai basically says, you're going to die. I mean, you're going to die either way. Mm-hmm. if you go before the king, you might die, but you might be able to save your people. If you don't go before the king, you're going to die.
Yeah, but he didn't know she was a Jew yet.
No, but Mordecai figures that somebody would figure it out, and she then would be killed as well, part of the edict.
Right.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
You know, and God placed, I mean, this is the whole thing we talked about last time. God placed her there, but then were Mordecai and Esther really faithful? That is in dispute.
Right.
So, but regardless, God is using them, and God can use the other pagan. You know, these at least had some, Mordecai and Esther at least had some knowledge of God.
Right. Right. Yep. Yes. So then we come up to verse 14, and it's just, as we study this, I mean, I think I've said this already, that I just had such a higher view of Esther. And now we're going to see in chapter 5 today that kind of finally there's this opportunity that she's presented again to stand up for her faith. And finally we see that. And we haven't seen that for 4 chapters. Really, I mean, you know, up until this point, Esther is just another person in the culture who's... Yes, he told her not to reveal her Jewishness, but still, as an individual, now she was young, and so she was respecting and honoring her authority. Yeah. But at the same time, then that still shows the family dynamic of not trusting God with your life in terms of your faith, that you were willing to hide it in the first place.
Well, because it's really contrasted with Daniel, who he refused to eat the king's food, and he didn't know when he asked, hey, can we eat a different diet?
What would happen?
What would happen? You know, but he was faithful, and God worked it all out.
Right.
But he did, it's not like he knew going into it, God's going to do something.
Right. And I think that is one of the biggest arguments for me that I see. We see these contrasting stories of these other people where you see them standing up, you know, in a pagan culture for their faith. And then you assume the consequence of, you stand up knowing that there may be a consequence. And so Mordecai could have said, he didn't have to say, you need to, you know, cover your Jewishness, because the king found favor with her, not knowing who she was from. He picked from every province. And so he didn't know what ethnicity, she wasn't even one of the royals. So it may or may not have mattered to him that she was a Jew. But we just seem to see this trend throughout these first 4 chapters, that they're just constantly, up until Mordecai urges her to go to the king. But they seem to just be very passive and allowing the culture to dictate their actions, and they just kind of go with whatever the culture is doing. Same for us here today, where you can easily put us in that position of, you are a Christian, you follow the Lord, you maybe go to church, but does your life, like, let's say you go to church, does your life outside of that, would people know that you're saved? And I feel like, in a sense, that's kind of Esther and Mordecai. They might even abide by, obviously here, I mean, even here when Mordecai tells her to go to the king, he still isn't saying, you know, you need to bow down before the Lord and, you know, ask him. He's saying, go to the king. So I feel like it's so easy to see them in the same light that we see many people who say that they are believers today. We see that across the nation, that there are people who say that they're a Christian and you wouldn't know it. looking at their life, because there's no evidence that their life is any different from that of the world. And it just really seems like Mordecai and Esther are in this same place, because the text is going to great lengths to leave out anything that would say that they were standing up for their faith, if they really truly were, you know. So why would he leave that out if it was there? No. Yeah. No, it's okay.
The whole tradition of tearing your clothes in the
Sabbath. Yeah. Yep.
It was
across the board. Yeah, it seemed to be, and I don't know how many of the different cultures would have, but it seemed that even Persian culture, yes, would have done that as well. They would have recognized that as a grieving process. And I think one of the notes I didn't get to last week about ashes, I thought was so interesting. There's different points in scripture where they'll say, it was kind of controversial whether the ashes is put on their head or whether they like rub it. And I read, it seems like there's several different places where it says something different. So the ashes, it just seems like is a sign of, that's a sign of mourning. So sometimes it was sprinkled on the head. Sometimes there are some texts that say they rolled in it or lay in it. But yes, it would have been a cultural, they all would have recognized it as a sign of mourning. I feel like there was something else about that I was thinking. Yeah. But it just was that the king did not want, you know, depressed people in his palace. So that was where kind of the, again, some people said it was a law. One commentator said he didn't think it was a law that you were not allowed to enter the palace. But most people said it was very frowned upon for you to enter the palace if you were wearing these sackcloth and ashes, because he doesn't want depressed people in his palace, because he's all about
nothing.
Right. Right. You're wearing a loincloth. Yeah. Right. Yep. It was
filthy.
Right. Right. Yep. So he's drawing a lot of attention to himself in terms of how he looks, and people know that he's in grief, but yeah, they would have all recognized that, which is so funny when Esther then doesn't like clue in to something's really wrong because he's dressed like this. She's clueless. She doesn't immediately think, oh, somebody died or something, you know, something terrible has happened. She's just like, go change your clothes. Like, what's wrong with you? You know, get your act together. And that's right. Right. And it's right. And I mean, it's possible that she did that. But it's just interesting that she didn't inquire as to what was wrong. She just kind of was like, you know, put on some other clothes. And then when it was referred back to her what had happened, then she realized and she was like, oh, okay. One commentator did say it was possible that maybe that was her intention, that maybe she was trying to make it possible for him to be able to come in. But it's hard. Sure. Right. Sure. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's, you know, if you guys ever go and study, you guys will find that it's interesting when you go in and read, because you have to read the text yourself and gather. And then you have certain commentators saying this and then other commentators saying that. And so when Mace and I were talking the other week, I'm like, man, it's hard. It's hard to see, okay, what was intended here? Because we only are given this, right? And, you know, it's in areas where we don't want to read between the lines, but then also we kind of, you know, like we're only given this. And so then how do we extract from that? Sure. 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 I know. Sure. And that's even where my struggle is. I want to be, I shouldn't say I want to be, but from the text, it seems more apparent to me that they are unfaithful to their Jewish devotedness, if that's a word. But there are some commentators who would stay on that side. But there are other commentators who, throughout the whole commentary, throughout the whole text, they believe all of these different actions were purely faithful, righteous actions, that they were purely living it out. And again, that's where it's hard, because truly, can I say, just because Daniel did it and they're not recording it here, can I say that that is a perfect argument? No, because there's a lot of things that are left out.
We don't know. You know, Daniel lived in Israel and was deported.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it was a little bit more of a...
They've been, more than, lots of years away from...
Right. Yep.
From, ancestors living in Israel. Right. So we don't know how much they had. Mm-hmm. We don't know how much was given to them by the priests or whatever, or their family, how much religious education was passed on. For certain, I don't know.
Sure. Right.
And even from church on Sunday, Nehemiah didn't go back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But he was still faithful.
Right.
And when he hears that Jerusalem is in shambles and the gates are burned, he mourns and pray, and then God uses him.
Right.
But he goes and promises to come back, and he does. He goes back to the king and goes back again. So.
Right.
So there were, so we knew there, we know there were faithful Jews.
Sure.
And that remained faithful even though they did not go back.
And I even wonder, could this have been this moment in the story where God allowed Esther to come to this pinnacle? I mean, you never would think that when you're presented all the time with these opportunities to stand up for the Lord, now in that one pinnacle moment when your life is at stake, oftentimes you wouldn't expect someone, now you're going to stand. Usually you'd think, you're just going to keep going along. But a part of me wonders, could this be that moment where maybe they are recognizing God's hand in all of this, and Esther getting chosen as queen, and whoever, and then following this kind of reignited their faith or their walk with the Lord? Again, that's only my opinion or my, speculation, looking at the text. There's nothing saying that, but I just wonder, could that be their moment of saying, all right, we need to get our act together and walk with the Lord and trust our life in his hands, because he's had his hand along this whole way.
Or maybe they felt like they were walking to the degree of the knowledge that they were aware of.
Sure.
And now a new situation presented themselves to make a more overt stand for their faith.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. It's hard when we want more and then there's this, but we have to be faithful with what we have. because it is enough. It's more than enough what we need. And so I'm trying in my study to not get so caught up in it having to be this precise detail, because we don't have enough to say precisely whether they were overtly righteous and living their life completely for the Lord or, not. There are things that to me suggest that they were being passive in their faithfulness. Esther never once said anything about her. I mean, ever came up against the empire in what she was asked to do or eat when she came into the harem. But the huge part of this story that we get to take away and learn is God's providence. It's just incredible to watch his hand throughout this, putting people who may not be so obedient to him, but yet putting them in positions to further his glory. And it's really, truly incredible to get to see that, his providence that way. Because it's so unlike any other book, where in any other book we see a lot of miracles and we see God physically even in some cases, but here he is so behind the scenes, and yet even still he is accomplishing his plan, and he is furthering us to bring glory to him. So I think for me, living in the era that we live in, where we don't see all the miracles happening, it's encouraging that, as dark as this world may seem, God is still working behind the scenes and still making his plan happen, regardless of how it looks around me or the circumstances look. And it's encouraging that he uses even people who maybe are not perfect. I mean, we've seen that through the whole Old Testament, but Alistair Beggs, he said, the purposes of God are much greater than the obedience or disobedience of one person. So he's saying, Esther, you're the person in the place for now, but don't think for a minute that God will not keep his promise to the covenant. So like we said last week, Now, if God had allowed the edict to go as it had first been stated and they would have died, God's promise still would have been kept because he wasn't wiping away the entire Jews, you know. But in his grace, he allowed them to live. He allowed this to be reversed in a sense. The purposes of God are much greater than the obedience or disobedience of one person. Mm-hmm. And I think it was this one and then another commentary that I'd read. And I just was crying when I was reading that because I'm like, wow, Lord, that you would use, I want so badly to do a good job at being a mom and being a wife and, ministering to my sisters around me. But I know my heart and I know how many times I fail. I already had to say I'm sorry to my son twice this morning before 9 o'clock. And so then it's those moments that I feel so humbled because I'm like, oh, I mess up so, so much. And yet I am confident that God's purposes are still going to prevail despite my failure. Now, I need to continue to pursue him and pursue righteousness and pursue good deeds. You know, I can't let it distract me from that and just say, well, forget it. He's going to do his thing anyway. You know, I can do whatever I want. For those of you who are in Sunday school on Sunday that Kyle was sharing, that there's this connection between sin and suffering. And, you know, we need to pursue his promises and his word, even though the world works differently in a sense of we see how justice, sometimes the person who does the good thing doesn't always get the good result, right? I mean, we see the opposite, even though in God's word, it says that as you pursue righteousness, you will be blessed. But oftentimes in our world, in our human physical world, we don't see that blessed result immediately. You know, not always. In the long run, it's still always better for us to do the right thing. And so I can't let his providence or his sovereignty make me late. I can't allow it to make me lazy in my pursuit of righteousness. But then as we go on in verse 14. Yes.
Do you think that Esther's eunuch and her other servants or whatever, mm-hmm. do you think that they knew?
Well, this Hakath, however you say his name, he found out in this conversation. Now, if that servant knew prior to that, we don't know. But he for sure knew now because Esther and Mordecai are going back and forth about... Right. Yep. So now definitely he knows. But whether they knew before, I would probably assume that they didn't know beforehand just because it seems like Esther's been pretty respectful of Mordecai's authority and she had no idea about this edict. And who would have thought to tell her because nobody knew that she was a Jew. And so it kind of leads me to believe that nobody really knew because she didn't know what was going on out there. But yes, we don't know for sure. We just know that at least now one person does know. And I don't know if this is I would assume that she trusts it, this person, you know, that he's going to deliver the word to where it needs to go, to Mordecai. So in verse 14, for if you keep chapter 4, verse 14, if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So Esther is being given this opportunity that, you know, Mordecai is kind of saying, maybe this is your chance. Maybe you get a chance to make a difference. And while we don't see God in the text, we can so hear that essence in what he's saying of how easy could it, you know, I can hear that God is even though Mordecai's not using his name, God is still utilizing him to encourage Esther that maybe this is what she was given for, was this moment. And we have many opportunities in our life. While it may not be saving an entire generation from genocide, we have so many opportunities in our life to be in the place for this time, to choose to do. And like, you know, we talked about last week, it doesn't have to be this one certain specific thing that God writes in the sky that you have to do X. There's so many things that we can do to honor the Lord in our life. It's just going and pursuing those things. And there's going to be a ripple effect of people who are going to be ministered by that when we choose to do what God has called us to do. In the text there in 14, it's kind of this idea of who knows? Who knows? How can we know in advance what will happen? We, just like with Joseph back in Egypt, if somebody would have asked him when he's standing in a square being sold as a slave, probably stripped naked, if somebody would have asked him at that time, who knows, Joseph? What's going on here? What's going on with what you're doing here? What's God doing with your life here? You know, I'm sure he would have said, who knows? Like, I have no idea, you know, what's going on. Or even when he was put in prison, you know, and falsely accused of something. And so if someone were to interview him and say, so what's going on here? Why are you in jail? And he's like, well, I didn't do anything. And they're like, well, what do you mean you didn't do anything? You don't go into jail for nothing. And he's like, well, who knows? You know, who knows why he's there? But yet God had a purpose in all of those things to allow him to be placed as second in command of all of Egypt, a Jew to be placed second in command of all of Egypt. And that is absolutely God's hand and his providence. And so for all of us in our life, we could look at so many circumstances in our life and think, what are you doing here, God? Where is this going? But we have so many story after story in the Bible who encourages us that we can, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here because I know you guys all know this, and you know that in the middle of even immense trial and heartache and tragedy, we can still have such hope. I mean, when I was talking to Katie last week, she's like, I know I'm praying for a miracle that my mom will live, but if she does pass and this is her time, then God is still good. And he is. And I pray that we say that now over and over again, so that when the time does come, nice job. When the time does come, that we can confidently say it, even then. I keep praying that for our family, that we will say it now, because so that when the time comes, we can truly live that and know that God is good, even in the midst of tragedy. All right. Okay, so then... So Esther, truly, she's being called out of the shadows, right? She's been tucked away in the harem, away from her people and away from the Jews, just essentially. And now she's being brought out of the shadows and brought into this position. And we all have opportunities for that as well in our life. Okay, so then verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. So now she's going to respond to Mordecai's admonition. And she says, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So she asks the community to fast with her because she knows what's about to happen. She knows this is a huge deal because either she's going to die because of the edict or she might die at the hand of the king when she goes before him. So she's probably a little freaked out right now about what she's about to do. So she's asking the community to all fast with her for 3 days. She's anticipating that this choice that she's going to make is there. It's a defining moment for her. So they are going to petition. Now, this was another area that I really, wrestled through, because it says, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast. So many other, I know we kind of touched on this last week, but so many other places in scripture, when it says fast, they had a fast, it says they fasted and prayed, or there was a link to a faithfulness to the Lord. And here it just says we had a fast. So now when I was going through this, and as I was reading through the commentaries, I was asking myself, there were some commentaries who assumed fast meant they are praying on behalf of the Lord. Now, even when you just, when you read the word fast, you would assume that that's what you're doing, you know, is you would be praying to the Lord and asking him to change something. You know, you're asking him to do something different. So with that, leaving out some of these other areas of the fast, I see that, I think it was, again, it was kind of one of these areas where it was a ritual, just like Catholics go and they confess, right? But there's not, it doesn't mean a lot when it doesn't come from a true heart of repentance to the Lord, right? It needs to be of a true heart of repentance. So I wonder, it's interesting to me that God still honors their fasting, even though it's not necessarily out of this devotion of wanting to honor the Lord. It's maybe just trying to get out of a dire situation, because now they're in this situation and they're like, oh my gosh, we need you now. We need you to like come down from heaven and, you know, stop him from this genocide. So this fast is not the same fast that accompanied the grief that they had earlier. This is a different form of fast that they're wanting to the situation to be changed. Also, this is a very exceptional fast. Typically, a fast only lasted apparently about 24, 26 hours or so. But her asking them to have a 3-day fast would have been exceptionally severe because it was so long. They didn't usually fast for that long. Until evening. And we can see that in 2 Samuel 1. Or, you know what? Actually, I don't know if 2 Samuel was the right. Let me just see quick. Because I think after I wrote it. Hold on. Let's see. 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 12. Yeah. So 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 12 says, and they mourned and wept fasting until evening. And earlier in there, it talks about mourning. So morning to evening was a typical fast. So this fast was extraordinarily long. She asked for 3 days. Okay. I think we talked about that already. Okay. So, I mean, when we step out in faith, as Esther is about to do, we can't know, like I said, we can't know the the end result, but we're trusting the Lord for whatever he wants to accomplish in it. We can trust him. One of the commentators said, we cannot know ahead of time how God will choose to use us. He may heal our diseases, transform our broken marriages, and plant thriving ministries through us. Or he may sustain us in obedient submission to him as our earthly hopes are dashed and our lives poured out for apparently little purpose. And I mean, I think we can all, I know I can think of times in my life where I wonder, I need to be obedient in my submission, even though my life has, there are certain parts of my life that haven't gone the way that I thought it would happen. But yet I still have hope that his purpose is still being, is still happening, regardless of what my circumstance is. And then, let's see, I think we covered that already. Okay.
Just here for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
She says, I and my maidens also will fast in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fascinating. I mean, did she suddenly say, I'm a Jew, here's our situation. We fast when we ask God. Want to ask God with me for something? You know, you don't know who I'm talking about.
Sure.
You know, what, how did
sure.
I thought that
I know.
Her maids you know? Aren't Jews.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Her maids
I know.
Are probably
They'd have
Persian.
To explain a whole lot of things unless they had, you know, they probably
sure.
had myriads of gods.
Sure.
I'm afraid of my God with me. But,
sure.
You know, for now.
Right. Right.
In a dire situation, whatever.
Right. Yeah,
then
for
she
sure.
Would have had to probably.
Sure. Yeah.
Unless the maids were just such as, we do everything she tells us.
Sure.
Without any question, she says we're fasting
sure.
and praying. We'll fast and pray.
Right.
What are we praying for? Just, you know, I don't know how much she divulged.
Right.
That
right.
would be interesting.
Right. Yeah, for sure. No, yeah, I know. I thought that was interesting too, that the maids were with her. And I mean, you know, she's been here for almost 5-6 years now. So she's developed a relationship with these women who would have been with her every day, helping her dress, helping her take care of.
Didn't know she was Jewish, but mm-hmm.
sure.
Didn't care because
sure.
it was not part
right.
of their lives.
Right.
You know, it didn't
right.
make any difference.
Right. Yeah, because at that time, it wasn't a hostile time. They weren't hostile towards Jews, and so
right.
it, yeah, right.
You're a Jew, I'm from this part of the country, I'm
right.
from this part of the country.
Right. Right, yeah, for sure, yeah, yeah. But it is, I mean, it's just, and then God honors that, you know, he honors that cry, and it's just amazing that, and we've seen it with the Jews before, where they don't have such a, they're not living such a great life or so devoted to the Lord, and yet he still honors their requests before him, even when they don't deserve it. He is very, very gracious, and I can learn a lot from that graciousness. Well, sorry, Diane, we didn't get into 5 before you had to go. Okay, yes. Yep. Okay, so chapter 5. Let's read verses 1 through 8, if somebody could read that for us.
Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And it happened when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her, "What is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom, it will be given to you." And Esther said, "If it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him." And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet, which Esther had prepared. And as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done." So Esther answered and said, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says."
Great. Thank you, Terry. Okay, so on the third day, Esther puts on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters. So that third day is likely the third day of their fasting. So this has come now to the end of their fasting. She puts on her royal robes. We don't know what she was wearing prior to this. One commentator said, well, maybe she was wearing sackcloth once she found out what Mordecai, you know, what was going on. And maybe she wore the sackcloth during the time that they were fasting. It's possible. But we don't know. She clothed herself in her finest clothing, because now remember, she's going before the king. The one who, you know, he's always found favor in her. He's always looked at her as beautiful. But now she's nervous. She's going to have to go before him after not having seen him in 30 days. So she's nervous that he's kind of lost his favor with her. Or he's, you know, found somebody else that maybe he's more favored by. So she's going to put on her royal robes to really present herself well before him, so that she could petition. And I even wonder, maybe she asked Haggai for advice about her clothing. You know, remember, because back in chapter 2, he gave her the advice of what to wear when she went before the king. But she put on the finest clothing to go before him. Now, I can too just imagine her having her servants or whoever helping her get ready. And you can just imagine her looking in the mirror before she's about to walk out of that room, you know, probably fixing her hair and fixing her makeup and, you know, making sure her clothes look great. And just, I can imagine myself looking in the mirror and just like talking myself into what I'm about to do. Because remember, there was axemen who stood in front of the king for anybody who came without being asked. And so now she is about to enter that. And so I'm sure she was went and fixed up her hair, looked in the mirror and took one more breath and said, all right, here I go. And then she had to walk down this massive hallway with these, remember we saw those giant pillars that were there, and she's got to walk down that giant hall. And the whole way, I'm sure if it was me, I would be thinking, oh my goodness, what am I about to do? I just have to keep my mind like, okay, one more step, one more step. And then she looks up and she sees the king, and he sees her immediately. It says, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite to the palace. And then verse 2 says, and when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. So as soon as the king sees her, she has won favor again. So he doesn't immediately banish her.
Is that normal? Let's just say he saw her and invited her, so to speak.
Yeah.
Let's say he just didn't happen to see her. Was there a protocol? And maybe you talked about it last week when I was gone, but is there a protocol for like getting his attention so
sure.
that he would see her and then
sure.
you know, decide whether he was going to invite her in?
It sounded like, and again, there's not hard evidence for this anywhere. There's not a document or anything, but some of the commentators were saying, like what Josephus has written, it seemed to imply that like the axeman would look at the king, like kind of nod over or say whoever was there and then ask his permission before they hacked off their
head. But if she was as beautiful as it said she was, I mean, imagine this beautiful, beautiful woman.
Right.
And you, how can you not miss her? You know?
Sure. Well, yeah, right.
He's looking at a magazine, right. You know. A document
right.
or doing something
right.
else or
yeah.
biting his
yeah.
nails or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So it didn't seem that they would, like, the moment someone touched,
okay.
it's just, they would, you know, ask the king, hey, is this person supposed to be,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
right, right, right. But it was everyone knew the risk that
right.
you were doing in coming because we know he's a hothead and he disposed, I mean, he didn't, doesn't seem he killed his other queen, but he disposed of her pretty quickly just for her not coming out naked, you know, in front of her. So he was quick to do those things. And there is record of him out when he, I think I said this last week, that when he was out canvassing the military guys, if they were out walking around, they were carrying him on his throne and somebody stepped in front of his threshold, they were immediately beheaded or cut in half. So there is record of that. So we do know that, I mean, this, everyone knew that you do not come before him unless you are asked. But yeah, the henchmen or the guys, you know, standing there with their axes probably would have nodded to him and said, hey, look who's here, you know, because I'm sure, I mean, they know she's the queen and,
right.
you know, she, yeah, so.
And she really, we don't know that she actually, just because she hasn't seen him for a month, doesn't mean that she fell for
right, right. She's just fearful of that. She's
right.
just fearful of that. We don't know that, right. She in her own mind, right,
right.
Because she said in chapter 4, she said, but I have not seen him for 30 days. And so she's just afraid that that means that he's not as fond of me as he once was. Right.
I've been married for 5 years.
Right.
Too, so
right.
He's probably gone to
right.
Well, he's still got that hair on me
right. right.
Right. And then the second
yep.
hair on me
is yes.
right.
Right. Yep. Yep. He's got lots of people. So against all odds, she has won favor in his sight, even though, you know, the custom was you were not to come before him uninvited, even though she hasn't seen him in 30 days and she thinks that she's lost favor. He still sees her as beautiful. Her beauty ignites him again. And he welcomes her in, ruffled by her coming. Okay, so then verse 3, and the king said to her, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you even up to half of my kingdom. So his, what is it? He's recognizing that this is unusual that she would have come, because he knows that she knows that there is great risk in you coming uninvited. And so he immediately assumes that there is something wrong that she's come. So he's asking, what's going on? What is and then his gesture of up to half a kingdom, it is very likely that that was not meant literally. It was just a kind of a common phrase for him to say that, you know, I'm going to give you generously. Whatever you're asking, I will give generously. So he didn't literally mean half the kingdom. It's,
I know,
just...
every time they say that, I want to be like, why didn't that person...
ask for half the kingdom?
Like with Herod and the daughter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
When she dances before him, he offers her half the kingdom. She's like a girl.
Right.
Right. All right.
I know.
I'll take half the kingdom.
There was... I couldn't find the full story, but I found just through Google, basically, that... there was a previous royal, a queen or something, or somebody in a royal position who Xerxes had said, I'll give you up to half the kingdom. And she kind of took him up on it in a certain sense. And then it ended badly, but I couldn't find the whole story. They weren't giving me the whole story, but, take up half the kingdom. So it was just a phrase expected that she was to expect generosity in her request. So, and then it allowed her to express her request even with confidence in him saying that, because he's saying, you know, I'm here for you. I'm willing to.
Today.
Right. Right. Yeah. He's probably merry with wine. So for Esther, it probably was tempting to just jump right to it, you know, to say, well, this is what I want, you know, after him saying that. But she's very, intentional. Yes, she's very wise and intentional in how she brings forth her request, because she doesn't just jump right into it. She strings them along.
Obviously, because doesn't she say, come this day to the bed
yes.
that I've prepared? She's already made
yep.
plan.
Yep, exactly. And so then it makes it very difficult for him to refuse, because she says, I've already made this banquet for you. So it's already prepared. Yep. Let's see. Well, and, you know, in the sense of, it would have been tempting to jump right to it, because for Esther, she doesn't have all of these big miraculous signs like what Joseph and, or, I mean, well, Moses and would have had, you know, that God, you know, showing himself right there. It's just her and her words that are being put forth. So she has to rely on a really good strategy in order to change the king's mind on this edict.
And that she already prepared the banquet.
Right.
Shows that she at least had some hope she would survive this.
Sure.
You know, but it might be like, well, I'm doing all this, but who knows
right.
if we'll even
right.
need it.
Right. Right. Yep. And I mean, it says, yeah. Yeah. The feast that I prepared for him. I was going to say something else, but, yeah, I think it was definitely, because she was said before, if I perish, I perish, because it is, it's kind of this 50-50 shot. We don't know what king we're going to get when we go before him, if he's just going to be like, nope. Yeah. So, okay. Then verse 5, then the king said, bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king brings Haman along and they go immediately to the feast. So her response is rather anticlimactic, because we thought, oh, she's gonna ask the big thing, and she doesn't. Like I said, she strings him along. And she's, you know, you can see that she's trying to sugarcoat it, in the sense where we've seen the same phrase, of if it please the king, in verse 4, where it says, and if it please the king, let the king and Haman come. We've heard that phrase before. So she is really trying to woo him in, be as politically correct or tactful. Well, because she knows that Haman is involved in the reason that the decree is even there. And so it seems, I wonder if she had this plan from the very beginning, like during the time of fasting, if she kind of formulated this plan of wanting to bring him along, because then she was going to reveal to the king in front of them what happened. Did she have that plan from the get-go, or did she make this up as she went? It's I don't know. But at least to some extent, she has had some steps planned ahead because she had already prepared the feast. So, and we're going to see in a little bit, probably a good reason why she had them come to another feast. But yeah, she just wanted him to come along because I think she wanted it to be in front of.
You know, I was just thinking about the food of those days. Didn't they have to prepare several things like way ahead?
I'm,
you know, like if they roasted a big pig. Or,
sure. Right. Know, right.
You know, they roasted a big cow. Right. Or they can't say, you know, like us, throw it in the microwave and then
right.
Ready, you know?
Right.
See, it makes sense that she would have, and maybe that was the best prank.
Uh-huh.
Gave her those ideas.
Sure. And it's possible whatever would be served that day, she had servants go and gather that, you know, for the feast, for whatever they were going to give, you know. But she was just saying, just so you know, I've prepared something, you know, for you to come and meet me. Because they didn't normally dine together. She hadn't seen him in 30 days. So they didn't normally eat, her and the king together. So she's just saying, I've invited you to come and eat with me, basically. So she's biding her time. She just invites him to the banquet. She's biding her time. She's not. It's not just, we don't really get this sense that she's losing her. It's just, I think that she has a purpose in this stringing them along a little bit. And she read the edict. She read the edict. And remember, he cast the lot. And this was at the beginning of the year that he cast the lot. And it cast the lot to fall upon the very end of the year. So they have a whole year. So she knew her time. It's not like it was pressing the next day that they were going to be slaughtered. You know, she knew she had enough time to really woo him. So she's expounding with flattery and favor by inviting him and Haman, his right-hand man, to the banquet. It's interesting because in chapter 1, Xerxes throws himself a banquet to honor himself, right? I mean, he throws the banquet for all the people, for the officials, for all the people of the land, and he's trying to chalk himself up to this big, amazing, wealthy guy, right? So he's throws himself a banquet to honor himself. But now here, Esther offers him a much more meaningful banquet, because when you're having to honor yourself, there's not quite as much honor there as opposed to when someone else wants to honor you, right? So she knows that is going to be a lot more meaningful to him, that she's going to invite him to this banquet to honor him. And again, like we already said, she makes it difficult for him to refuse because she says she's already prepared it. So then do we read verse 5? Then the king said, bring Haman quickly. Yeah, we did read that. We also know that she's probably kind of, like I said, pandering to his ego, pandering to his honor. And he consents immediately. He's like, yep, we'll go. And what's also funny is he says, bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther asked. And so it can literally be read, the king acted according to the word of Esther. So one of the commentators said, so much for his earlier decree that each man should be master of his own house. That was funny.
She's asking him to do something he wants to do. You know?
Right, right. I know. He just thought it was kind of ironic. Okay, so then verse 6, and as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. So she's really kissing up to him. She kind of begins and then she sort of breaks off. But again, I do think it's very intentional. I don't think she was just losing her nerve, because now again, we're seeing that in verse 7, then Esther answered, my wish and my request, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said. So she kind of starts, my wish and my request, and then says, and if I have found favor, and if it please the king, and grant my wish, you know, she's like really, really expounding on his favor and over again, several times. And then she invites them to another feast again. So what it seems to be is that she's kind of trying to move the king to have to keep to his word, because now again he has said, I will give you half the kingdom. So if he goes back on that, if finally when she gives her request and he goes back on that and doesn't grant her her request, it's kind of, he's not going to be able to save face in front of the kingdom, because now he said this and then he didn't do the one thing that she asked. So in a way, she's kind of forcing him into this position of granting her request almost. So, I mean, she's very intelligent or sneaky. I don't know which way you could look at that. Conniving. It does seem that she knows exactly what she's doing. She's not just getting out at the last second. She's, you know, trying to create this idea of he is going to grant her request. Let's see. And then she ends by placing herself under the king's authority, under his word, by implying that the second banquet is a part of her compliance to the king, because she says, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. So at the end, she's trying to put him under the authority of his word, to show her respect of his authority. And he would lose a great deal of respect from the people surrounding him if he went back on his promise. Okay, so then could somebody read for us verses 9 through 14?
Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him, and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she has prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then Zeresh his wife and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made.
Oh boy.
Man, Haman is
worse than king, I think.
Well,
he has quite the ego.
Yes, he does. Right. So I mean, he's going out in high spirits, he's happy, he's joyful, he's had wine, and then one man does one thing, or really doesn't do one thing, essentially.
He doesn't do anything.
It's just that he doesn't stand up. And, oh, he's lost it. He's angry, and he has just lost it. Now, he did, you know, keep from taking out vengeance immediately right there, and he went back to his wife. But not just from the intoxicating effect from pride, he has now, he is being intoxicated by the effect of pride, really. So he's so prideful because he's like, now Mordecai won't bow, even stand before me, or, you know, bow before me again. And how dare you not stand before me? So his pride is being puffed up.
Well, and it seems too that he's mad that Mordecai's not afraid of him. Because
now
of Mordecai,
this edict has,
he has said, I'm going to kill all your people. And
sure.
Still, Mordecai is
sure.
not afraid
yep.
of him or won't even
right.
move.
Right.
Even though he's threatened.
Right. Yep. Yep. And that doesn't do very good things for your ego when, when you have a big ego. He craved significance. Not just significance, but also being seen to be significant. Haman wanted everyone to see that he was to be respected and have authority. He wanted to be seen as significant by everyone, including Mordecai, and especially Mordecai. He's coming off of being very probably excited and giddy over the fact that Esther was honoring him, because she did. She honored him by inviting him for the first banquet and now to the second. And so in his mind, he's thinking, see, I'm second in command, and even Esther thinks that I'm one to be praised and bowed down to. You know, she thinks that I should be honored. And so he's coming off of that being so excited, and now it's contrasted with Mordecai, and he's like, how dare you? Who do you think you are?
Well, and maybe Haman thought that, well, because of this edict, Mordecai should try to, you know, curry favor and go over the top to
sure.
try to maybe get him to change
right.
his mind or whatever.
Right.
You
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Gain
right.
favor with Haman so that Haman will back off.
Right. His emotional strings were being pulled by his idol pride and public respect. He wanted that. And it led to anger. He was not happy. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. But in verse 10, it says, nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. So he's like, okay, keeps himself from just slaughtering them right there. Or, you know, I can only imagine probably what he was thinking, wanting to wring his neck. And he goes home and he brings around all his closest confidants, all his, you know, the one of the commentators said that it could be translated where it says his friends. It could also be translated his advisors or wise men. So yeah, I mean, loosely, it's the people who are closest to him that know him well. And obviously his wife who knows him well. And then he goes on to tell them of all of the amazing things that he's done and all the wealth that he has, and including how many sons, like as if his wife didn't know how many children she birthed. Like, really, Haman? Oh man, I just laughed. I'm like, yep. Wow. So he's pumping up his ego, even though all these people know these things. You know, I'm sure all these people know how much wealth he has. I'm sure, you know, they all know that already, but yet he has to remind them of how great and mighty he is.
Because his pride has been bruised.
Yeah, right. His pride has been bruised. Yep. Yes, he's got to bolster his confidence by going and letting all the people who already know how great he is, right? So his wealth, his sons, his promotions were all listed in detail. He puffs up his accomplishments. These would have been his closest people. And he's trying to claim the same honor that Esther was inadvertently bestowing upon him. And then in verse 12, Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast. So nobody else was allowed to go, just me, you guys. Do you understand how important I am? He idolized public recognition to its core. And when anything came in the way of that, it caused him great anger. It's also ironic that a Jew both stroked and enraged his pride. So yeah. Esther, you know, being a Jew, she was allowing him to be prideful in his ego, but then a Jew was also the one who totally popped that balloon. Okay, let's see where we are. Haman is crying out for someone to guide him and direct him in his empowering negative emotions. So he's asking the people around him for advice of what to do, right? Because then Haman said it, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the feast that she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Verse 13, yet all this is worth nothing to me so as long as Mordecai the Jew is sitting at the gate. So it doesn't matter who else is going to honor him, because one person is also not showing. He cannot handle that. That's too much. So he's asking, looking for what he's to do about this. He needed biblical counsel, right, to handle those negative emotions. But he turns to the counsel of those around him, which are not going to give him biblical counsel. They say, yeah, go. Go and do what makes you feel good. Go with your feelings. Go and destroy those people, Mordecai, because it's going to make you feel better. We can identify with that. We can identify with that feeling of dealing with our own hearts and how our hearts can have idols, and how we react to when our idol is triggered, in a sense, whether it's your pride or when that is triggered, it's so easy to want to react in a way that will avenge your feelings. But biblical counsel would say, no, you have to take that captive. You have to take that anger captive. You cannot act out in it. Let's see. I think we covered that part already. It's showing the condition of his heart, right? His rage was an opportunity to discern that, the condition of his heart. It uncovers a God-shaped hole in the center of his life. There's a huge and important thing missing in his life, and that is God. And we know there's nothing that can fill that. You will never be able to fulfill pride, no matter who honors you. We see right here, it doesn't matter that the king honored Haman. It doesn't matter that Esther honored Haman. The two people in the realm who would have had the most respect, it didn't matter because Mordecai also was not standing with them and honoring him. And so he couldn't handle that. And so we know that pride will never be able to fill that void in our life, ever. It will never, the things of this world will never be able to fill that. Only God can fill that void. And again, it wasn't enough for him. So since Haman did not seek biblical counsel, the counsel that he got was just to make you feel good and satisfy your rage. So a gallows was built 75 feet high, was suggested by his wife. You know, it's just so crazy how his own wife, I mean, I don't know.
Well,
I don't know
she
what.
Probably
yeah.
She had to stoke his ego to keep
right.
him happy at home.
Right.
You know, because right. she might suffer the brunt of it.
Right.
You know?
That's true. Right. Especially because the edict that was made before of the
yes.
wives need to be submissive to your husbands. Right. So that 50 cubits would have been about 75 feet. It's highly likely that this is probably a hyperbole because they said 75 feet. A lot of the commentators said that would have just been absurd. That height would have been so absurd. 75 feet. That's, I mean, that is outrageously high. So some commentators said this may be a hyperbole for the actual dimensions of it. But it could have also included the hill that it may have been on, because the whole point of it being tall is so that you are placed high above so that everyone can see you and that you're shamed. It wants to, the whole point of it is for you to have shame upon you by everyone being able to see it. So that's why she's suggesting such a high, a very tall one. So it's possible that maybe it actually was 75 feet, but several of the commentators felt that because of a lot of other cultural things that would have just been outrageously high, that it would have been it would have been difficult to build. It would have, you know, all these things. So they wonder if it was more so determining the height of the hill as well of the gallows built on top of it. And it was just to be outrageously high so that there was immense amount of shame brought to the person that was hung there or impaled there. I think we talked about in the very beginning that impalement, it could have either been an impalement. They were not necessarily a hanging like we think of a hanging noose. Usually in that culture, they were impaled to a tree or a wood that would have been hung up for the gallows. So I mean, how disturbing that is. I know she's probably trying to save her own security and whatever backlash she might get from him, but it's a little disturbing that the wife comes up with the idea.
Maybe she's right along beside him and then she's offended that Mordecai
maybe.
Won't power before mm-hmm. her husband.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah, maybe.
And women can be just as evil.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Jezebel.
Right. Yep. So they're going for a giant size vengeance. When we feed our idolatry rather than starve it, we are always left feeling emptier than ever. And we are left in greater bondage than before. Our strong emotion reactions enable us to read our own hearts better. So when we respond strongly to something, usually it tells what's going on really in our heart. When I get so frustrated at the boys when they don't obey me the first time, it's telling that, how dare you not respect my authority? And it's you know, now obviously there is a very real sense of that, that they need to learn that. But for me to get so angry and be so upset by it, it's telling that I think that I am so important that you should obey me. So our hearts reveal such the condition of our heart. I mean, our hearts reveal, our actions reveal the condition of our heart. That's what I meant to say. And then in the end there where it says, and it pleased Haman, like, again, a little disturbing that it pleased him, the thought of him being impaled. But, you know, our pride will do that. It will blind us to disturbing things, truly.
Well, these are completely unregenerate.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which glories in evil.
Right. Especially when you've practiced evil. You know, because there are people out there who don't know the Lord, who are good people, and I think would think that hanging someone on a gallows is, you know, disturbing. But yeah, when you practice evil and you practice serving that idol in your heart, then anything sounds good to appease that. You will go to no length. It's ironic that the gallows that he hastily builds will be for his own use. The feud that was there between him and Mordecai, it would have been solved. It was going to be solved by the edict that was supposed to happen, you know, nine months from now, a year from now.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, he was going to get, Haman was going to win in the end, and he knew that, but
right.
He didn't wait that
long. Right, yeah, something had to be done now. Mm-hmm. And so, even though it was already going to be solved, he couldn't handle it, and then ironically, the very thing that he built for him was going to be used for Haman. All right. So just I wrote down a few notes at the end that I thought were kind of interesting as I was thinking about this chapter, that sometimes there's a place for dealing subtly with the culture around you. Like in Esther, she's going in pretty like subtly under the, you know, ring. She's not coming in guns a-blazing. You know, she's really trying to appease them and win over their favor. There's other points, obviously, we've seen with Daniel that you know, there's that phrase, dare to be a Daniel, that you have to stand up and ask right out. But sometimes dealing subtly and in meekness is better in the long run in how we do things. And, you know, I think in areas where right now I see so many Christians, okay, because we have social media and people talk so much on there and people, they want to call out the darkness or the sin, and that's fine to call that out, but there is a certain place and time to do that, because when you just kind of slash somebody over the head with this is not true, it very rarely turns out that they are ever going to see your side, you know. Very rarely they're going to dig their heels just as much in their side as opposed to your side. But if we can come alongside them and see their deepest need and present Christ that way and present the truth that way, it's much more likely that they're going to be receptive to what you have to say, as opposed to just, if Esther had come in, you got to do this for me, you got to save all the Jews, you know, it may not have gone so well in her favor, because she'd come in commanding in an authoritative way. But she is very wise, and she takes her time, and she knows that she has the time to do that. And so she's going to try her best to make this work. His providence is also something that we have to hold in tension. Like I said earlier, I struggle with this because, so God is in control of all things, and he works all things according to his holy will for the glory of our own good. And Romans 8:28 says that. However, we are not passive in this process. We do according to our own desires and temperaments. God's sovereignty operates in such a way that our freedom and our responsibility to act are not compromised. Yet, the end result is still exactly what God has purposed from the beginning. So we have to work out our own salvation, as it says in Philippians, that it's so, like, when you think about it too long, your brain just wants to explode, because you're like, how do you do that, God? How do you allow us to act out our own desires and wills and choices, but yet you still accomplish your will? How do you use even my sinfulness for your will? How does that make any sense? It doesn't make any sense in my mind, but I trust it because I know that that he is so much greater than I, that his choices to use those things are his perfect plan. Also, God achieves his perfect goal, not just through our best intentions and self-sacrificing acts, but even through our greatest sins and compromises. And that was the one that I was just sobbing as I read that, because I was like, oh, my goodness, Lord. Because there are so many times where even when I'm trying hard to honor him, I know that there is still failure even in those times. And even my best intentions, it's still coated in sin, because nothing that we do is perfect enough for him. And so it's so humbling that he uses me in spite of who I am and how sinful my heart can be. And I am just so grateful that we serve a God that we don't have to like carefully create this plan of how we're going to approach him and how we're going to talk to him and how we're going to ask him for a favor. We get to come boldly before his throne and ask. We get to have a personal relationship with him, and we don't have to fear. And the reason, so this was so huge, when I was thinking about it, the reason he can hold out that golden rod to us is because of the fierce rod of judgment that he fell upon Christ when he died on the cross. That's the reason that we get to have that golden scepter poured out to us at any moment, because Christ received the ultimate judgment. And so I am so grateful for that. Very, very grateful. But all right. Well, that is all I have for today. We're done a little bit early. I will pray and then we can go. Any questions before we go? I always forget to ask that. Okay. All right. Lord, thank you so much for this time. Thank you for allowing us to be able to come together and freely study your word together, Lord. I pray that we have this opportunity for many, many, many more years. So I just thank you so much for each of these ladies. I pray that they learned about you today. I pray that they learned about more of your character, and I pray that your how you have revealed yourself, change how we live our life, that we would get to live it in such a great hope, knowing that your plan is to be accomplished, that we are here to bring you our sole purpose, to bring you glory. I pray that we would go about living our lives that way and taking the opportunity when we need to do what Esther did and be bold and be strong even in the face of danger. So I pray that you, just that we would know that our boldness comes from you, comes from a strength in you, Lord. We can have such confidence in that. In your name.